Welcome to this week's episode of the Media Voices podcast. I'm Chris Sutcliffe.
I'm Esther Thorpe.
And I'm Peter Houston.
So this week I spoke to Jess Brammer, who is the executive editor at HuffPost UK. So we talked about the flurry of launches they've just had over the past few weeks. They've launched a lot. From the HuffPost School of Journalism in association with Birmingham City University. And also some new sections they've launched on their site, which replaces the blog section. She also discusses what it's like moving from broadcast journalism to digital journalism and how she keeps her team motivated during the non-stop Brexit news cycle. Sorry, we're 2 minutes in and we've mentioned Brexit already.
Well, I think it might come up again today.
Yeah, I think it might as well.
Actually, you know what? Let's use that as a segue. The big flashpoint in UK media this week was that industry magazine Campaign, who are a B2B title, they cover marketing and a little bit of media as well, and they ran, as part of their Love and Hate issue, a feature on the Brexit Party leader and ex-UKIP leader Nigel Farage. Did either of you see any of this coverage, or was it, did you mainly get this sort of splashback from its publication?
Splashback.
Definite splashback.
They got absolutely slaughtered for this. And rightly so. You know, so I'm going to say right up front, I haven't read this piece. The story can be whatever the story is. The point is, they put his smug old Brexit McShit face on the cover of the magazine.
It was very Don Draper, wasn't it?
It's ridiculous.
I thought, yeah, we definitely ought to include the cover in the newsletter.
Just I'm not putting ruin that everybody's face in the newsletter. I'll put a link to it.
But I think there are a couple of context points for people who might not be as familiar with what has happened as some of us in the UK. So what they actually did with him on the cover is that they had this big sort of black and white picture of him smoking like this huge cigar. It was very sort of 60s. I mean, they had this strap line that was, oh, advertising. I might fancy it myself one day.
Once I've
gosh. And for anybody who doesn't know who Nigel Farage is, he's the current Brexit Party leader, isn't he?
Unelected Brexit Party leader.
And Brexit are currently, if you believe local polling, now the second biggest party in the UK, despite not existing 5 months ago. And he was the ex-UKIP leader who was like one of the massive Brexit figures for spreading sort of lies and anti-immigration, racism and all the other unpleasant things that generally led to the Brexit referendum.
Yeah, it was an interesting call. I did read the piece. I went through it. I have my own issues with the content of it. But you're right. It's very.
Well, you
done
so you read the piece. What's your take on the actual piece?
I think it was a huge miscalculation on Campaign's part. I did email them and say if they want to come on and talk about it, then we'd be very happy to have them on. They didn't get back to us. It's ostensibly about what can the marketing world learn from the Brexit Party. Because that is a legitimate topic that people can talk about. I've seen a lot about how the Brexit Party colour, you know, immediately identifies itself as being sort of separate from all the other political parties at the moment. You know, people have compared it to that of Change UK, which was kind of a disastrous brand.
I can think of other parties people have compared it to.
So there is definitely something to that. I think where the piece fails is that it offers no criticism whatsoever of Farage the man or of his identitarian far-right racist politics in favour of being this kind of weird glowing profile of the man. So I'm going to quote a little bit from it now, just to illustrate what I mean. So it says, Farage laughs a lot during the interview, usually at his own one-liners. He does so with such gusto, it is hard not to laugh along with him.
Oh, God.
Yeah, I know, which at the time when, you know, the BBC are publishing, doesn't this neo-Nazi look dapper articles, and, you know, in the aftermath of Jimmy Fallon ruffling the racist Donald Trump's hair on his show. Why would Campaign, which is a B2B magazine and doesn't have to follow the news agenda, give this man any airtime?
What's bizarre about this, in Campaign particularly, is one of the things he's best known for is this absolutely odious anti-immigration ad.
Yeah.
Which people have drawn direct parallels with propaganda that was run in Nazi Germany.
Yeah. Well,
And that makes an interesting case study, but it should, like, it shouldn't be glorified like that.
To be fair to Campaign, I'm going to play devil's advocate here. And
really?
The devil in this case is Campaign. It is not Farage, because comparisons with Farage are unflattering to the devil. You know, they do talk about the Breaking Point poster. They say that, you know, it's shocking, but that's it. They offer no criticism as to the fact that it is absolute bollocks and has been shown repeatedly to be nonsense.
Oh, man.
Wait, I didn't end up playing devil's advocate there, did I?
No, you didn't.
They just mentioned it. Okay.
You just basically said how shit the article was.
Do you accept the premise that there is a story here, that the rise of the Brexit Party and an examination of the rhetoric that they use is worth covering?
Absolutely. I mean, I know a lot of people have drawn comparisons to Hitler unfairly or fairly or however.
Or in illustration.
It's like you can't study World War II and the consequences of that without looking at why the Nazi Party was so popular and why it did really well in Germany. You can't just say, oh, that's bad, we're not going to talk about it. You do have to look at the reasons why it succeeded and why it did work among popular opinion. And it's a similar sort of thing here. You know, how has the Brexit Party come to rise? What it needs to be studied with is challenge. You can't sit there and grin and have a beer with him. You need to challenge him.
But also they're doing this B2B thing, which is a problem for me. We're looking at the Brexit Party as a brand. Oh, the colour's different. Oh, their message cut through, blah, blah, blah. You can't do that without looking at the policies.
Yeah.
You've got to talk about the policies. And I haven't read the piece, but it sounds like they didn't really do that.
No, they didn't. And it's strange, actually, going back to that B2B point, this is a bad look for the advertising industry right now because it's in the middle of a trust crisis. Trust and public favorability towards advertising is at its lowest ebb. I think it mildly rebounded this year, but it's still like very, very low. So why would you focus on somebody who has been shown to just be bluster and no substance?
Bad decision.
Also, it doesn't actually mention the two. Sorry, it actually doesn't mention the two lessons you can learn about marketing from the Brexit Party. One, political advertising is unregulated, so you can make whatever fatuous statements you want. Cough, £350 million to our NHS. Cough, and appealing to people's fear of, you know, Johnny Foreigner and enabling racists is a surefire vote winner anyway in times of austerity. There is nothing unique about what Farage is doing. He's the embodiment of that kind of grey, boring evil that you see rise up whenever people are feeling scared about their own place in the world.
But also, they pitched this as a love and hate issue, right? Yeah. Well, all I'm seeing on that cover is the self-love of Nigel Farage. It's just onanistic bullshit of him smugly smiling out of that cover. Where's the hate? You know, if...
Does that cover not make you want to punch him?
If Campaign had done a clever publishing industry thing and published two covers, one of which was Farage smiling like a loon and the other one was throwing a milkshake at him, then that would have got that love and hate message across.
A lot of the fault with this seems to lie with the editor and the way that this has been put together rather than the concept. It's just really badly executed.
She's apologised though, yeah?
Well, yeah, and that, we should talk about that as well, but I think that a lot of the fault actually lies with the interview here. Peter, you mentioned that B2B people tend to get overwhelmed.
Well, so I just read this somewhere else and it made sense that a B2B journalist who's used to interviewing industry figures about an industry they know a lot about, when they're confronted with an interview or given an interview with a kind of national celebrity who's probably a dominant figure, they can be overwhelmed by it. And they end up, not because they want to, but because they maybe don't have the experience of someone like Laura Kunzberg, BBC political editor. They can't cut through and they end up doing a bit of a PR job for the person.
This is like that time I had a dream about Donald Trump coming on the podcast and everybody got really angry at us because we'd featured Donald Trump. And I was like, but we can't turn Donald Trump down.
To be fair, we don't know whether Paul Simpson, who is credited as the author, was even the one who conducted the interview. Mm. You know, we don't know what the kind of the chain of command was almost. That's a Star Trek reference.
So can I get madly cynical for a minute?
Wait, whoa, what do you mean get madly cynical?
Are we not being cynical right now?
Well, I think we're being very negative. You know, is there an argument that Campaign's done this just for the attention?
Yeah.
Can I dispute that? Because I think from a lot of the replies I saw under the tweet, which were like 99% negative, I think they've, because the industry is, our industry is kind of so small and tight like that, a lot of people were like, that's it, you know, I'm cancelling my subscription. I'm not being part of an organisation that puts stuff like this out.
They must have anticipated it to some extent, though. And in the initial aftermath of the publication, their replies on Twitter...
Oh, their poor social media manager.
Yeah, I know, right? But they tended to be along the lines of, we stand by the reporting. You know, it was part of our love and hate issue, and we're examining this as kind of as a
That comes down to ratios again, doesn't it? Like, it's the number of people that say, "Oh, actually, yeah, you've done like a I get your love and hate issue," and then there's people being like, "Yeah, you just put a fascist on your front cover," and they I think they've kind of realised they've been like, "Oh, actually, yeah, we've stepped over the line on this one."
Well, I mean, let's examine that the apology now, because I actually think the apology itself is quite good. I think it's a little bit exculpatory. They say, well, it's Claire Beale, who's the editor, says, "We strove to understand, but certainly not to lionize Farage's politics. We wanted to initiate a discussion about the rise of Farage and the Brexit Party brand and how it has contributed to the situation that we, as an industry and a country, find ourselves in." But the problem is that the piece does lionize Farage. It humanizes him, and it humanizes him at a time when you can't give a voice to the far right like that.
It also separates the brand from the policies.
But Claire also has said, you know, they're still listening. You can email her directly. She's included a link to her personal email at the bottom.
Oh, geez.
And as Esther mentioned, they are doing that listening forum.
She gets brownie points for putting her email out like that. Holy crap. I did see there was a letter from Media for All, who I'm not totally familiar with, but obviously they're a media kind of board, a media group that is trying to get more inclusivity going on, and they got ripped in, and Campaign has published their letter. I mean, the kind of crux of their letter is, "The only lesson that our industry should draw from this playbook is not to have any part in it," which is pretty straightforward.
That's a very war games sort of like response.
And they've Campaign has actually published that, so that's cool.
Yeah,
you know, I think, you know, it's so easy to look at that cover with his smug old face on it and want to hate Campaign. If they made a mistake, and they genuinely made a mistake, and they're trying to roll back from it, then well done, good luck. I hope it all works out for them. I've got one thing left to say on this.
Okay.
Stop Brexit!
I've got one more thing left to say on this to a lot of political and news outlets. Stop interviewing Farage.
Yeah, there you go. Nothing to be gained, a lot to lose.
Boom.
Moving on then, somebody who profiles but doesn't lionize Nigel Farage, The New European. It's dropped its micro paywall, which was provided by Axate, formerly Agate, in favour of a Guardian-style approach. So, Esther, what has happened here?
Okay, so, I'm a bit of a micropayments fan, and I like talking about all things micropayments. So this is quite an interesting one this week, and it's seen this usual wave of, oh, micropayments don't work. And actually, when you look into it, what the New European have chosen to do makes complete sense, given their, I think, passionate audience is one way of describing them. So again, the New European, for people who don't know, it started up just after the Brexit vote. It was originally supposed to be a four-week magazine pop-up. And, I mean, it's still going. How many years has it been? Three years?
It's third anniversary last week.
They're getting, like, 2 million visitors a month online now. And they're kind of very pro-EU, anti-Brexit, all about trying to disperse a lot of what's going on and basically fight to keep us in the EU. So they've got this kind of following. What do they describe themselves as? For the 49%, don't they? Or is it the 48%. Yeah. And so they've got these people that come to the site, and they're very, very passionate about the issues. And they experiment with this micropayments system where you basically load up like £2 or £3 in a wallet. They had some premium articles, and then it would sort of deduct this cost if you read a premium article. And what Matt Kelly has said is actually, given the type of audience they have, a lot of people are coming to them saying, "Well, we want to support you with more than just like 10p or 50p. Like, you know, we want to support your cause. We want to support your journalism in like a Guardian style way." So they've basically gone and implemented, there's a nice big yellow box at the bottom of their articles that is basically like, support the New European. And it's got, you know, you can donate monthly, annually, or as a one-off. So I think given their audience and given the type of stuff they do, it's quite smart. But that doesn't mean micropayments don't work.
No, absolutely not. And in fact, just to give balance, Axate then announced that they'd signed up Sci-Fi Now as another user of it. You know, they famously, the hot bitch, the kind of scurrilous gossip blog, who we've actually interviewed their editor on here, Dominic Young, who's kind of the CEO, I think, of Axate. He's hinted at, you know, more people coming down the pike, including spectator-like partners. So this isn't it sounds very amicable. It sounds like a very amicable thing. They're just shifting more towards a business model they think works better for them. And I think that Arch will still use it.
Yeah, Potbitch implemented it in a slightly different way. So they used to have adverts, and what they said instead is actually we're going to put everything behind this micropay wall. And if you read more than three things, we won't charge you past that. So it's just kind of for the really regular readers, you'll get charged like how like I think it was like 10p per article. And actually after that, you if you're a really committed reader, you're not going to be charged sort of loads for absolutely everything. And they signed up about 3,000 people in their first couple of weeks for that. So that is still working really, really well for them. I think the new Europeans approach was, I don't want to say it wasn't quite as committed, but it was a little bit different and just didn't really work for them. So
why can't they do both though?
I suppose just because it was the perception then would be that there would be double dipping.
Yeah, and I think you need to be clear with your proposition. There needs to be like one call to action at the bottom of your articles, not a mix.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I do. I agree with that. That people are more likely to give just because it's the New European or it's Positive News or it's the Guardian than if you were talking about something like, I don't know, just like a more mainstream type.
I think you get a mug if you contribute as well. Chris, can you confirm that?
Can confirm. Get a mug.
Get a mug. Stop Brexit.
Okay, so news in briefs. Gannett and Gatehouse look to be merging, which means that they would own one out of every six daily newspapers in America. This may well have actually happened by the time this goes out, but on Friday it was kind of almost a done deal.
Yeah, the implication seems to be that they're you know buying this up effectively to give them more time to make digital work again. Consolidation in service of future sustainability.
Also, don't they have a reputation for cost cutting and which generally means jobs?
Yeah. Yep. Going in, stripping it out, moving on. And talking about moving on, Netflix has lost subscribers in the US for the first time in 8 years, dropping a net 130,000 customers in the second quarter of this year. That's what you get when you don't renew Daredevil.
Well, what's going on?
They have increased their prices.
Yeah, they have done that too. I think it's in part that, and in part the fact that they have so many more competitors now than they used to. And
I mean, like all the Disney titles have gone now. Disney are just about to launch their Disney Plus or whatever.
It's always Plus. And yeah, it's interesting as well that I think we're going to see many more fly-by-night subscribers who will sign up for 1 month when something that they desperately want to watch is on there and then just take their money somewhere else.
Well, every time I've thought about cancelling Netflix, they've launched a new season of something I want to watch, like Stranger Things.
Do you know, there was another launch this week that I've forgotten to put in here. So, you know this BritBox thing that's coming between ITV and the BBC? Well, that's going to be $5.99 a month, but apparently you still need a TV licence.
Yeah, well, they're going to start jacking the prices up, and that'll be it.
No, not for UK customers.
Candyman. Reach, it's Trinity Mirror and Old Money, is in early talks to acquire key assets from JPI Media, that's formerly Johnston Press. We don't know what it is, it just says certain assets. So it's like this big switcheroo where they just keep moving stuff around and hoping they can make it work. So here's to it. So don't forget, we have a transcript section on our website. You can read the words, the actual words, for every interview that we have conducted in the past, I don't know, 9 months, maybe? This is all thanks to our partnership with Trent, very clever little AI, which goes in, strips out our voices and turns it into actual readable words.
Even Peter's voice.
Oh, racism again. What, you and Mr. Farage has got a thing going on here? What? Visit voices.media/transcripts to read all our interviews.
So this week I spoke to Jess Brammer, who is the executive editor at HuffPost UK. She talks us through some of the things they've launched over the past few weeks, as well as the changes social media has made to the news cycle. But first I asked her what her day-to-day role at HuffPost involves.
So I'm the executive editor, which means that I run the editorial side of it, basically. I run the newsroom. I came in as head of news, and my role has expanded in the last month, really, to encompass the other sections.
And it's been a really big week, well, a really big couple of weeks for you guys with all the announcements that are coming out. I think you announced the closure of your blog section last week. I think the US also announced that they had like a contributor platform, didn't they, which I think is quite similar.
Yeah, so the US did it a while ago. We sort of half did it about a year and a half ago. So I think the thing is, first of all, to say that, yes, we did close it, but we launched two new sections, Opinion and Personal, which are really exciting and encompass some of the best bits of the blog's platform. And The thing to remember is that when Arianna Huffington launched the Huffington Post and they had this incredible platform where they raised, or they elevated lots of voices that weren't heard in the media at the time, and they were really, really ahead of their time. Mm. It was before Twitter really got going, before everybody had a kind of platform with which to give their views and give their point of view. And at the time, it was really revolutionary. Fast forward to where we are now, it feels outdated not to be paying writers. And, you know, we wanted to sort that out. And we also wanted to have much more control over the content that's on the website. So we'd moved a long way away from the original thing, which was kind of people self-publishing and using our website as a platform, which was very exciting back then. And now, obviously,
I suppose that's now a medium, isn't it, if you want to do that?
Yeah, yeah, I guess it is. Or even Twitter, to be honest, a long Twitter thread, which you could write quite a lot of words on. So for us, it felt like taking the best bits, which is elevating unheard voices, making sure that the site is still populated with lots of those things, and really distinct, compelling, interesting experiences. So our personal section will be about telling those personal stories, and we've had some really great ones already this week. We've got an amazing one on the site today about a woman who is talking about how every time she dates a man, she's worried that he's gonna Google her and discover that she was a rape victim. So it's a place, you know, within the media and within our site where we can carry incredible stories like that. And then the other half is the opinion section. So we will continue to kind of have agenda setting, opinion pieces, but we will be paying people who write for a living.
And does that mean you guys will have a lot more oversight about kind of what is published, a bit more quality control, that sort of thing?
Yeah, I mean, we were sort of there already. Yeah. To be honest, we'd moved to a much more rigorous system of editing, and we've massively cut down the amount that we were publishing. But this is very specifically a commission rather than submission role. So yeah, even more than we were already doing.
And you've recently relaunched the Life section as well. What's changed around that?
So if you take a look at the site, something very obvious has changed and it suddenly looks really beautiful. Yeah. So we've relaunched it with lots of new graphics. It actually looks distinct from the news section, which I'm really excited about because our live content is fantastic. And obviously it feels texturally really different from the news stuff. And it's really nice to give it a home on the site that elevates it and shows that it's that you're coming to get something slightly different to what you would get on news. But also we've built out the specialisms of our reporters. Somebody like Sophie Gallagher is focusing on sex and relationships, and we're kind of building that up as a specialism. Yeah. She's launched a brilliant section called Sex Diaries where we where people talk about their sex lives. There's some great variety on that. And, you know, it's about depth, and it's about giving it a place that shows we're really proud of it, I suppose. Not that it's kind of an add-on to what we're doing on news.
Yeah. And has that had any impact? Because I think that changed a couple of months ago. Has that had any impact since?
Yeah, I think it has had an impact, definitely in terms of the response we've had from readers, and then also in kind of finding a place for us to do more thoughtful life stuff. Our brilliant life team have been doing quite a lot of that over the last year and a half, but now it really feels like there's a place on the site where those things can live, and I think that's really exciting.
Sounds a bit sort of magazine-y almost.
Yeah, I mean, I quite like to think of our readers as people who don't differentiate between different types of content as much as I think journalists obsess about. So I quite like the idea of them coming and dipping in. And, you know, I personally love the stuff that they do on Life where they kind of tell me which lipsticks to buy or, you know, where to find the best houseplants for my flat. And that can sit alongside the new stuff. But I think there's a real place for, you said magazine-y content, but lifestyle content, you know, stuff that kind of helps you to spend your money better and use your free time best, especially when politically, you know, it's pretty depressing times.
And do you find there's a different way that people kind of come to access that news content versus the lifestyle content? So do they come through social for the lifestyle or...?
It's a mixture, really. We have a very distributed platform model, which was purposeful. I think we all saw across the industry when Facebook turned those taps off. Exactly. Some outlets literally basically ceased to exist because they were so hooked up to one particular platform. So we're fairly evenly distributed, and that's across news and life. I mean, obviously, something like Twitter will drive a lot of news or politics traffic because we have such a brilliant politics team. Somebody like Paul Waugh, who's our political editor, his Twitter feed alone will drive lots of traffic. And then some life stuff or entertainment stuff might be better suited to Facebook. So we still get quite a lot of traffic through Facebook. And then there's other third-party apps like Flipboard or Upday. So it's a mixture, to be honest, and homepage traffic, of course.
And you've just launched the HuffPost School of Journalism, which you're doing in partnership with Birmingham City University. Can you talk us through some of the reasoning behind that and why you've chosen to get involved with Birmingham?
Yeah, I'm really, really excited about it on a personal basis, actually, as well as kind of what it will mean for us at HuffPost. So I think Birmingham, first of all, a year ago, we actually closed the London newsroom and we spent a week running a newsroom out of an empty shop in Birmingham city centre. And that was about trying to see what happens to a news outlet when you move the centre of gravity and you step away from London, where most news outlets are based, certainly nationally. And also what happens when you place yourself in people's lives. So one of the biggest thing that I learned from that was actually that it wasn't so important that we were in Birmingham as much as we were in a shopping centre. So lots of people popped in on their lunch break. They came in after work because they'd heard that there were this crazy bunch of journalists doing this thing in the Bullring. And it was a really interesting way of talking to people in a space where they weren't expecting to talk to journalists or encounter news. And I think one of the big challenges for the industry when, frankly, we're competing not just against other news outlets, but we're competing with the likes of Netflix, you know, what are you going to read or watch or look at on your way to work? Maybe news, but also you might be catching up on your favourite TV show. I think finding spaces to kind of pop up in people's lives at their own convenience, frankly, is something that we all need to be looking more at. So we had that Birmingham legacy. We had a fantastic time in that city, and we discovered it was full of all these great stories. It's a very young city. It's a very diverse city. So there was that Birmingham legacy, which kind of was the beginning of that relationship with Birmingham City. But more than that, I really like what they're about as a university. They have a real focus on making students employable. They have a very diverse student body, and that sense of opening up journalism and making it more diverse, not for kind of worthy reasons, but because that's the way to make journalism survive and thrive in the future. We have to write news that is relevant to people. We have to have journalists that reflect the people that they're writing for, not kind of making patrician statements about the way that things are that don't make any sense to people. So there was a real synergy there, I think, in terms of the kind of visions that we have and the team at BCU. And also they're about a multi-platform approach that feels very modern to me. Quite a lot of academic approaches to journalism are still based on whether you focus on broadcast or whether you focus on print. And that's starting to feel increasingly just not the way that the industry works. You know, I've worked in TV, I've worked in digital. We are having to kind of move across and be more multi-platform. But also it doesn't really relate to the way that consumers think about content. I hate the word content, but think about, news or entertainment or lifestyle coverage
anymore. A lot of time they don't, they'll just get to it and not sort of think about that process.
Yeah, and if your main way of accessing news is your mobile phone, which it is for lots of people, you might watch a bit of video, you might look at sort of infographic, you might read a long read on your mobile phone, you might have saved it for your commute home from work. And I think we need to loosen up a bit as an industry and recognise that some of the boundaries in terms of platforms that frankly I was trained to believe in, they're just not there anymore.
Yeah. And that partnership with you guys in Birmingham City University, what do both sides get out of it? Like, what does the actual partnership look like?
So the sort of brass tacks of it is that we will help them set some module questions. We can give them access to a really busy national digital newsroom and also a global newsroom. So we're obviously originally an American company, although we have sort of full editorial autonomy here. We have outlets in India, in Canada, in Brazil. We're like a Pulitzer Prize winning news organization, and that's a nice thing to have access to if you're a journalism student. And I think it's just injecting some of the realism of like the real pressures and the real decisions that are made in newsrooms. So I'm hoping that doing things like pitching stories to us and our editors will give them a sense of the real kind of decision making as it actually happens in newsrooms. So I think we have a lot to offer them. I also think they have an enormous amount to offer us, which is really, really exciting. They've got this great student body who will be able to talk to some of the stuff that I was just talking about, and the way that young people access news and information. And you know, I'm excited about some of the things I'm going to learn from them that I have no idea even exist. You know, there'll be platforms that they are accessing news or information from that me, I'm 36, I probably don't even know that they exist. So yeah, that's really exciting for us.
You've worked in places like BBC, the ITV, you've sort of gone from broadcast to digital journalism. What are there lots of new things you've had to learn, or are a lot of the skills the same? Like, what's it like kind of transferring from those two?
Yeah, it's interesting. It's something I get asked a lot, actually. And I was quite far through the process of deciding to move from my previous job in broadcast. I mean, I was a producer for a decade, so I was totally rooted in broadcast journalism. But I was quite far through that process before someone said to me, God, you'll be leaving telly. And I, to be honest, I hadn't really thought about it. Which sounds mad, but I think once, particularly once you get to editor level, storytelling is storytelling and news editing is news editing. And if you're grappling with interesting ways to tell, to find compelling stories and tell them, it doesn't really matter what the medium is, if that makes sense. So it's been, in some ways, it's been less different than I expected.
Mm.
We're still trying to find interesting ways to tell stories.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, I've had to learn, I've had a crash course in SEO and CMS and various yeah, other acronyms that I wasn't particularly across before I started here. Also, we use Slack, the messaging app, to run our newsroom, something I had never come across before I arrived here. And I still find people will ask me a question on Slack and I'll stand up and give them a verbal answer, which to a millennial newsroom can be a bit confusing, I think, sometimes.
And are there things during that time that you've seen in the way journalism has changed? Because I think people say, you know, these days we're a lot more polarised. I'm interested if that's actually the case.
Yeah, I mean, journalism has changed loads since I first started out. I've been a journalist for 12 years now, I think, from being a very junior researcher on Question Time when I first started out. And, you know, the digital revolution and social media has basically put a bomb under lots of things, but yeah, certainly under journalism. Mm. You know, I'm a female journalist. I'm subject to constant abuse from members of the public every day on social media. Something
that I just put out a piece about that, haven't you?
I did, actually. In fact, the piece I wrote wasn't so much about the abuse. It was just about the low-level patronising responses that you get from a lot of men. And the abuse is, funnily enough, in a different bucket. I would put that in a different category. And, you know, I'm a white woman. It's even worse for colleagues of mine who are people of colour. It's pretty disgusting, I think. And that is just part and parcel of being a vocal and seen journalists on social media. So there's that. I also think social media is full and was full of opportunity. It did open up and sort of led to what some people have described as the democratization of journalism. But within that, it shook some of the values that we had around sort of fact checking and truthfulness. And I hate the term fake news, but it's unavoidably true that amount of information coming from that many different sources, many of whom are completely unverifiable, has been like a massive danger to the news industry. And I think in the early days of the digital explosion, it also meant that in the rush to kind of understand it, newsrooms hired lots of young people because the people in charge didn't understand digital.
Yeah.
And even towards the end of my time at the BBC, there were some brilliant people doing digital at BBC. They have such exciting stuff going on. But in some bits of the BBC, the digital job is still done by like the most junior person on the team. That's crazy. Like, digital journalism is not a separate adjunct of journalism now. It is journalism. Yeah. You can't avoid it. And I think that more traditional places, that terrible term legacy media, has been slow to pick up on that. And I think that it is in danger of not surviving because of it, basically. So in answer to your question, it has changed massively in so many different ways. there is opportunity in that. It's not all negative.
I was going to say, do you think sort of fast forward 5-10 years down the line, it will all shake out and calm down, or are we? Is it just kind of on a downwards trajectory?
Oh, God knows. I mean, if I knew the answer to that, I'd be a very rich woman. I think I don't believe it's on a downward trajectory. The fact that, I mean, I run a digital only newsroom, right? That wouldn't have existed 30 years ago. And we are doing great on the ground reporting. We still have the same values of old fashioned, solid shoe leather reporting, proper journalism, credible stuff. You know, all our sources are cast iron, verifiable. And I think we're now at a phase in journalism and digital journalism where we're kind of circling back to some of those things, and they've become more important than ever. And actually, in that very crowded, chaotic landscape, and with things like fake news, I actually think some of, you know, proper journalism has become more important than ever. It's just sad that the legacy of those years has meant that maybe the public don't realise that. And obviously, getting people to pay for journalism is the thing that none of us have really unlocked. And that's
the dream.
But, you know, I'm just as bad. I used to go, if I'd get on a flight, I would buy a magazine. Now, you know, I might, or if I'm getting my nails done, I might sit and scroll through Instagram, which I'm not paying for. Yeah. So it's interesting because I'm both a consumer of journalism and a journalist.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking all the time, like, what are the ways that we can persuade people about the value of what we're doing?
And I think especially for your UK team, a lot of the Brexit coverage must have been absolutely non-stop for the last 2 years.
Mm.
How do you kind of manage the team, like, keep them going when the pace of the news cycle is like that?
That's a really good question. Although I was thinking about this because actually, things have started to slow down a little bit this summer. I mean, we're getting a new Prime Minister next week. Obviously, that's a massive thing.
I think that'll probably kick it on into gear again.
Well, it may, but then it may end up meaning that everybody goes on holiday after that. We actually get a silly season for the first time in a few years. But it's been going on for much longer than Brexit. Personally, as someone who has been in the thick of it for the last few years, we had the summer leading up to the Scottish referendum. Then we had the Jeremy Corbyn takeover of the Labour Party, which obviously kept us all extremely busy. Then we had Brexit. It has been a completely mad few years. And amidst all that, I spent a summer for Newsnight in Greece because Europe was also collapsing at the time economically. I think we're all exhausted, but I think we're all going to look back and think, God, what a time we live. What a time to be a journalist. And if you're not enjoying covering this, then you're probably not in the right job, to be honest. It is exhausting. But, you know, like that's what we're here for, to thrive on this stuff and to be excited by it. And so, yeah, I think you just have to make sure that you're also living a life outside of work.
Yeah. How do you think that is for the readers? Because at the same time, you guys are producing all of this and trying to keep up with all of us. So are the general public. You know, people talked about news fatigue quite a bit recently.
It's interesting because I was on the panel for the launch of the Reuters digital journalism report. And news fatigue came out of that very strongly. And Brexit fatigue in particular came out of that. And I said then, and I would stand by it now, that I don't know how honest the public are being about that. because the biggest days for us in terms of traffic are the big Brexit days. If you were to take a dispassionate, objective, outsider look at our traffic numbers, you would come away with the impression that the public cannot read enough about Brexit. It's really interesting. But when I say that, within that, it's explaining Brexit.
Mm.
It's not assuming a lot of prior knowledge. And also, a BBC apprentice said to me last year that they find with Brexit coverage, they feel like they've come in at, I think it was like season 7, episode 3, and so they can't engage with it.
Yeah.
So that's something that I say back to our newsroom a lot. What's the thing that we want explaining today? And I say a lot, there's no such thing as a stupid question.
Yeah.
I've sort of finagled our like entertainment team into doing Brexit coverage. And, you know, I want the Life team to be involved next week when we get the new Prime Minister. Because it's so valuable to have people who aren't covering it day in, day out. And then on top of that, you know, we've also got our politics team who have the best contacts and who can kind of get the best exclusives. But always we're saying, who are we writing this for? And if something is interesting to us but not interesting to readers, well, there's no point in writing it.
And what's been the most memorable story you've worked on in your time as a journalist?
Can I say more than one?
Yeah, as long as it's not Brexit.
No. God, actually, I wouldn't have ever considered it to be Brexit. That's because there's not one story. I think maybe in 10 years' time.
It's an ongoing saga.
Yeah, it would be very hard to say it's Brexit. I think it's the ones that have made an impact on people's lives. So I did, when I was at ITN, I was Laura Kingsburg's producer when she was the business editor there. And we did some work around the garment trade and a factory called Rana Plaza collapsed in Bangladesh. And we went over there and we did some stuff around that with all the victims and kind of holding to the fire the feet of the big British and international brands who had been in that factory. And then we went back to do a follow-up piece. And while we were out there, another factory set on fire. And we drove to the factory overnight and we arrived there and the fire was still burning and it was horrific and some of the garment workers had died. And all on the way there, we rang various international brands that we knew were operating in Bangladesh and they all denied having anything to do with that factory. And we turned up, there were no other journalists there, and we went into the building and we found soggy from all the water that had been used to put out the fire, all the records of all of the order books from all the big UK brands, and they were forced to pay up. And that wasn't a story that lots of people will remember. The amounts of money involved were probably a rounding error for those big companies. But to know that if we hadn't been there, they wouldn't have had to pay up, was just like massively important for us, I think. So that's something that will really stick with me. And then on a completely different note, I think the last story that I did at Newsnight, the Westminster bullying scandal with Lucinda Day and Chris Cook, which when we were working on that story, it took us months and months, and Lucinda and Chris did the most incredibly diligent job of, I think we had nearly 80 sources in the end. And we knew that we were going to make allegations about John Bercow, which many of our BBC colleagues thought, you know, were
I mean, that's still ongoing.
It's just still ongoing.
Sort of simmering.
And when we first put those right of replies in, I can't remember the wording, but basically the parliamentary authorities said this is nonsense. And now there's been, as you say, it's still ongoing. It's now a known thing that there is a bullying scandal in Westminster. And that would not have been known if Lucinda and Chris hadn't worked very hard on that story. And it was great for me as well because it was the first big investigation I did as an editor. Mm. And that transition from kind of being the reporter or the producer to being an editor, you sort of, you worry that you won't be so deeply involved in the stories. But I think it was a great learning experience for me as well because it was kind of up to me when we went with the story, like how much more information we kept gathering, whether we made it focused on John Bercow or, you know, where we went with it. And it was just a really extraordinary experience.
And the last thing we ask all our guests is what's the last thing you saw, read, watched that really affected you?
Actually, I'm going to pick something that isn't journalistic because one of the, you asked about how we balance a heavy news cycle with managing to cope with it all. And I watch an awful lot of TV that has nothing to do with news. And I've recently watched Chernobyl and I found that really affecting and completely fantastic. And it certainly put things in perspective for the kind of news that we're covering. I read a lot of news stuff and lots of it affects me a lot, but I would like to choose something that isn't related to news.
And we get it, you've just heard the big feature of the episode, but please do stick around for the outro because we're going to share some quite interesting stuff with you. So first of all, did you know that we do a newsletter? But you can sign up for that at voices.media. It contains links out to everything interesting we found, everything we've written from the past week, and a link to the most recent episode to remind you in case you forgot to check your podcast app first thing on Monday afternoon.
And we're also on Twitter. You can get on there at Media Voices Pod and you'll see the stuff that we're following along, that we're retweeting, that we're commenting on, the social channel. And we have a website, voices.media. You can go and find all that stuff on that website. Links to current episodes, links to old episodes, links to transcripts, links to stuff we've written, all sorts of stuff. Go and have a look.
And we are also announcing the first few judges this week for our Publisher Podcast Awards. So keep an eye out on Twitter on that. You can follow directly at Pub Pod Awards. No, that's not an awards for pubs, that's Publisher Podcast Awards. Or you can go to voices.media where we'll put a little piece out about our first set of judges and who is involved in that. There are some good names.
But until next week, when we're going to be back with another episode of Media Voices, thank you very much for listening and goodbye.
Stop putting Farage on your covers!